The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Millions of people have been displaced by war in Syria. An estimated 4 million have left the country in perilous treks across borders, on land, or in rickety boats. But it was the image of a drowned boy, 3-year-old Aylin Kurdi, who washed up dead on a Turkish beach that caught the world's attention. The photograph triggered outrage, sadness, millions in donations, and perhaps some guilt among those of us living comfortable lives, knowing that tens of thousands of children like him die every single day. There are people who devote their lives and considerable resources to saving the world's most vulnerable people and animals, sometimes putting themselves or their families at risk to help complete strangers. Larissa McFarker is staff writer of The New Yorker, and she profiles extreme do-gooders in a new book called Strangers Drowning, grappling with impossible idealism, drastic choices, and the overpowering urge to help. And Larissa McFarker joins us now from NPR in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
When you told people that you were writing a book about do-gooders, that's the word you had to come up with, some assumed that people so committed to others are mentally ill or perverse. They're targets of derision and contempt. Why is that? Doing good is so suspect.
This really surprised me. I mean, I started out on this project just wanting to know more about people who devoted their lives to others and what those lives were like and what those people were like and how they came to that sense of duty. And the first sort of person that I interviewed was a group of people who had donated one of their kidneys to a stranger. And I was startled to discover how much hostility they had encountered in doing it. Their family would object. They would say, well, if you've got a spare kidney, how about me or the children? What happens if we get sick? Why are you giving it away to a stranger? Even the doctors were profoundly suspicious of these would-be donors and subjected them to batteries of psychological tests to make sure they weren't nuts, that they weren't doing it for some unacceptable reason. And indeed, about something like half the transplant centers in this country won't deal with altruistic donors at all, people who want to donate to a stranger, because the whole concept is too weird to them. And I ended up sketching a whole history of the origins of this skepticism. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations famously introducing the idea of the invisible hand, the idea that all of us acting selfishly can collectively bring about more good for society, perhaps, than if we tried to achieve that good. To give just one other example, there was a French anthropologist named Marcel Mauss who in 1925 wrote a book called The Gift, in which he discussed traditional societies he'd studied and pointed out that in those societies, giving was always reciprocal. A gift given without expectation of anything in return was not, as we often think of it, thought to be a higher, more selfless act. It was quite the reverse. It was thought to be aggressive because it gave the giver more power. It caused the recipient to lose face. It made him look dependent, a charity case. And in one of the languages Mauss studied, a gift given without expectation of return had a synonym, poison.
We've brought up so many interesting things there. I'd love to just kind of break some of them down. This kind of idea of the familial relation of those who are the do-gooders, which comes up in an extreme form in the case of Hector and Sue Badeau, if I'm pronouncing their name properly. French-Canadian family, settled in Vermont, and adopted And that's then adopted all of these other children, you know, of various different needs, some of them really troubled, some of them physically troubled, emotionally troubled. So we get to see, like, what's on the other side of heroism, of do-gooderness. How does it affect the people who are supposedly being helped?
It can be very, very complicated. And I'm glad you brought this up because, to my mind, this is the deepest conflict that do-gooders face. You know, when we think about the barriers to helping others more than we do, we usually think of fairly petty things like, oh, we're too selfish, we're too conventional, we're too lazy, we're stuck in our ways. All of that is true, of course, but there's a much deeper difficulty faced by do-gooders, which is that if you're going to care for strangers and devote your whole life to them, it's going to conflict with your caring for your family. And most of us not only want to care for our family, we feel that that's the right thing to do. So we find it a little strange and a little worrisome when a do-gooder is willing to put his family aside in order to help somebody else. So the Badeaus are a more complicated case. It wasn't so clear, family versus strangers, because these are a couple, as you say, who adopted 20 kids. In other words, found 20 children who were still strangers to them and made them into their family. And in the early days, it was easier because the family was more manageable. It was four, it was five, it was six. But as the family grew larger and the kids grew older, before adopting new kids, Sue and Hector would hold a family meeting. And usually the kids were in favor, but as the family got bigger, they started to object. And they would say things like, "Mom and Dad, we don't get enough attention as it is. It's too big. This family is big enough. You got to stop adopting." This would affect them like it would affect any parent. And yet, that was not all they thought about. For them, they thought, well, it's true. If we bring in another child, another four children who have most of them profound needs, it will take away some of our time and attention from the children we already have. On the other hand, think of those children whom we don't yet know, but we know their situation and we know that their lives are going to be so much harder if they don't have parents, so much worse if they don't have a family to call their own, that it's worth it to make the children we already have suffer from a little less attention if it totally transforms the life of somebody else.
That's what's so fascinating to me, the moral calculation that goes on for people. And this leads to the title of your book, Strangers Drowning. Now, this is from an essay from the philosopher Peter Singer. It was called Famine, Affluence, and Morality. And basically, he observed that if you walked past a shallow pond in which a child was drowning, you would consider yourself barbaric if you didn't come to the child's rescue for fear of muddying your clothes, right? So there's this argument that he makes that it doesn't matter if you can't see that child drowning across the globe. They are still drowning. Wouldn't you do everything that you possibly could in your power to change this? So it opens up this whole dynamic of the spatial nature of giving help, that if we can't see, if somebody is not close to us in our own family, we won't extend the same kind of help, or there won't be the same kind of urgency. How does that play out in the lives of the people that you profiled?
It's a very good question because I think for most of us, space and proximity are very deep moral facts. Peter Singer tries to make us feel as though space is morally irrelevant and therefore it should not matter at all whether this drowning child is right in front of us or halfway across the world. But actually, proximity is a very deep fact to most of us, and so is vividness. If we see a child in front of us, we not only perceive that need, but we feel it. And if we see a photograph, for instance, of that poor toddler that you mentioned earlier, drowning off the coast of Greece, we are moved to help him in a way that we weren't, even though before we knew that there were people of all ages drowning off the coast of Europe because they were refugees, but we didn't feel it until we saw that photograph, many of us. That's one of the differences between the people I'm writing about, these profoundly committed do-gooders, and the rest of us. They don't need a photograph. They don't need to see someone right in front of them because they have, I came to think of it as almost an aesthetic ability to conjure vividly in their imaginations the suffering of people whom they will never know, never meet. They feel it. So, for instance, I write about a couple who live just outside Boston, Jeff Kaufman and Julia Wise, and their form of altruism is fairly abstract. It does not involve seeing people right in front of them. It involves writing checks. When Julia was in college, she thought, I should become an aid worker in some foreign country. And then she thought, actually, here I am living in America with a first world education. Probably the best thing I can do is not go over there to some foreign country that I don't understand and try to be an aid worker myself, but stay here, earn money, and send as much of it as I possibly can. And she and her husband send away 50% of their salary, joint salaries. Send as much money as I possibly can to effective charities who can then use it to bankroll 3 or 4 aid workers who would be much more effective than I would by myself. When people hear about their story, I find that sometimes people find it unmoving and even repellent, the idea of an altruism that is so divorced, as they see it, from empathy, from the feeling you get from seeing someone in need. But for Julia and Jeff, it's a kind of modesty. It's a realization that they could use their resources trying themselves to help people in their neighborhood, but they would be less effective than if they gave as much money as they possibly could to aid workers who know their own countries better than they do.
What leads people to do extreme good in the world? And why are some people so committed to helping others, even complete strangers, sometimes at the cost of their own families? Well, Larissa McFarker is with us. She's a writer for The New Yorker, and she's written a new book about extreme do-gooders called Strangers Drowning. There is a moment early in the relationship of Julia and her then-boyfriend, Jeff Kaufman, when he buys her a $4 candy apple. Right. And it provokes such anguish in her. Like, I could have bought a malaria net for that $4. You know, there's a question of what is enough. And that's where I see the passion and the warmth. But there's also activists who get together and say, you know, there's kind of a humble bragging about you can save more lives than Oscar Schindler doing this, or I've saved more lives than Superman. If human lives are on a spreadsheet, that feels to me cold. That feels to me calculating.
There's no question that there are some altruists who think about their altruism in a very cool, rational way, and they don't necessarily get moved to tears by the suffering of people far away. They just coldly decide, it is my duty to help them as much as I can because I have so much and they have so little. It's simply what I must do. Now, I think such people deserve enormous credit because they have done much more than most of us do. In the case of Julia and the candy apple, that, you know, it's a funny story because this was Julia at age, I believe, 21 or 22. And she was still at a very overwhelmed, passionate, emotional stage in her moral life. It's hilarious to think about. And indeed, Julia herself finds it hilarious now because she's done something that's very hard. Over the course of her 20s, she's now, I think, 30, she figured out, along with her husband, a system that would set some moral parameters because they both realized that evening, if Julia was going to burst into tears every time she made a tiny little purchase because she thought of malarial children sort of clawing at her windows and saying, how could you? She was going to lose her mind, right? And that was not going to be to anyone's benefit. Another decision that Julia and Jeff had to confront, which was a much larger decision than a candy apple, was whether or not to have a child. Julia had always wanted to have a child since she was a child herself. She always used to imagine games she would play with her kids, toys she would make for them. And then at a certain point, it occurred to her, oh, if I have a child, that will take away an enormous amount of resources that I would otherwise have given to charity. So by having my own child, I will, in effect, be killing other people's children. And then eventually she realized, you know, if I don't have a child, that will be the point at which I feel like my life is not just constrained, but blighted. And it will destroy me.
Paul Wagner is the man that you profile who gave a kidney to a stranger that he found on, you know, a website who was needy. his original instinct was to not let that person know who he was. He wanted to do it anonymously because he suspected his own motivations of heroism, you know, his own ego appeasement. And we mentioned earlier how people sort of feel judged by do-gooders. I wonder if we knew more about what these people were doing, about their sort of normal acts of heroism and selflessness, would we be encouraged to do more ourselves?
That's a very interesting question, because we may know that giving more makes us happier, but if we also feel, perhaps even unconsciously, that giving more will make us into a different kind of person, someone more self-righteous, someone more judgmental, then our desire not to become that person may be too strong for our impulse to give. So that was part of the reason I wrote this book, was I wanted to restore a sense of the beauty and the grandeur of very moral lives, which I felt had become obscured with all kinds of cliches and notions about how do-gooders are unhealthy and twisted and generally weird. And I wanted to give a sense that these people are tough and relentless and extraordinary, and hopefully by so doing, take away some of the barriers to the rest of us wanting to do more good.
Larissa McFarker, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
Larissa McFarker, she's staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the book Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. There's much more on the book. You can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Actress turned lifestyle blogger Gwyneth Paltrow is now notorious for sharing new agey, often bizarre advice. Readers of her website Goop are often the first to hear about vegan recipes, new products, and the actress's personal life, like the frequently mocked term consciously uncoupling, which she used to announce the split with her then-husband Chris Martin. Generally, her advice is considered laughable, but pretty much harmless, except when flu season comes around. Alexandra Soa is clinical instructor in medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, and she wrote about Gwyneth Paltrow's dangerous advice for Slate. Alexandra, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So what was the advice that Gwyneth was giving about combating the flu?
Well, I saw a picture of her on her Instagram. She was looking dewy and glowy, and she was under a nice red light. And I read the caption, and she said she had the flu, and she was treating it in an infrared sauna. And I thought, oh my goodness, what dangerous advice.
Why is that so dangerous?
Well, there are a few things we can do to combat the flu. One, I advocate everyone getting their flu shots. I just have to get that in. And then you have to practice common sense and good hygiene. And by taking yourself to a sauna when you're sick, you are neither practicing common sense or good hygiene, because you're leaving your home where you're isolated and you're going into a public space and spreading all sorts of bodily germs. It's a pretty germy environment. And so that's number one. Number two, and probably the more important health takeaway message here, is that treating your flu in a sauna, you're just going to be exacerbating dehydration, which can be a fatal complication of the flu. The whole point of a sauna is to increase your temperature, but with the flu can already come a temperature, and you sweat, and you release all sorts of fluids. And this is really where I thought, you know, this is where people could be very harmed.
Well, Alexandra, do you not have a sauna in your home, as we all do?
Oh, no, I wish, but I don't, sadly.
Well, it is one thing when someone forwards bad flu advice, you know, in an email chain or tells a friend, oh, you've got to sweat it out. Do celebrities saying these sort of things inflict more damage?
Of course, of course. So on any given clinic day, I have 15 to 20 patients come in, and I can share with them my advice from a doctor perspective, but Gwyneth Paltrow has over 1.4 million Instagram followers right now. And that gets blasted out to so many more people. So you have to assume that although she's not saying you should go to the sauna to treat your flu, that people will just infer that because she's doing it, she recommends it, they should do it too.
Well, how serious is the flu?
It is serious, and it does kill people. Most people with immunocompetent systems, meaning healthy people, will be able to fight it off at home, and they should. They should stay home. They should hydrate. They should take over-the-counter medications. But there are people that do not have the ability to fight off the flu. And these are young people, people over the age of 65, anyone with chronic illness. And these are the people that are at highest risk to have fatal complications from the flu. And every year, about 200,000 people will be hospitalized, and a quarter of those people will die. Mm. So yes, it can be a very serious illness.
So what is your recommendation for people wanting to recover from the flu?
To recover from the flu, rest. Isolate yourself. Practice common sense. If you are sick, stay home. Have people bring chicken soup to you. Drink tea. Hydrate. All of the things that your grandmother told you to do, they work. So you're going to drink lots of fluids, rest, and stay home.
Granny over Gwyneth.
Yeah, granny over Gwyneth, yes.
Alexandra, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Alexandra Soa is clinical instructor in medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, and we did find her article, Gwyneth Paltrow's Dangerous Advice, at Slate. You'll find a link to read it for yourself, and of course, to see that dewy picture of Gwynny at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Well, I have to tell you, I hear phenomenal things. I hear your wife is a lovely woman.
She is. She's
I don't
fantastic.
Know her, and this
she is
a total
absolutely the love of my life, and she's right here. And why don't
Good.
You apologize
Good.
For her?
No, I won't
right
do that
now.
Because I said nothing
yeah.
wrong. But I do hear
so
she's a lovely
that
woman.
That is that the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails.
Thank you. Me too. Me too.
This is not a cage match.
Secretary Clinton, do you want to respond?
No.
Governor.
No. The New Hampshire primary is months away, but debates between Republican and Democratic candidates have already provided a treasure trove of quotes and gaffes and memorable exchanges. While Republicans are gearing up for yet another debate next week, we thought we'd remind you of some of the historical zingers like these.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
You know who voted for it? You might never know. That one. You know who voted against it? Me.
They brought us whole binders full of women.
I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit my opponent's youth and inexperience.
NHPR reporter, host, and resident historian of presidential oddities, Brady Carlson, is with us. Brady, great to have you with us.
Hi there.
Have there always been presidential debates?
No, it's a relatively new thing. We sort of harken back to the Lincoln-Douglas debates in the Illinois U.S. Senate election of 1858. On the presidential level, the Kennedy-Nixon debates were the first, and certainly the first televised debates, but it was not a normal thing. And in fact, even after Nixon-Kennedy, it was not a normal thing. Richard Nixon did not debate in 1968. When he ran again for the presidency. He did not debate when he was running for re-election in 1972. It wasn't until Ford and Carter in the 1976 election that you started to see debates become a regular part of the election cycle.
But they've become a huge feature of elections. I'm thinking of the 1960 debate between Richard Nixon and Jack Kennedy, that first televised debate. Huge news, but did that set the bar too high and expectations too high?
Well, it certainly set a kind of standard that you're going to have this very formal. I mean, the mechanics of the general election debates often tend to have that same style of the two candidates, the Republican and the Democrat, standing at podiums answering questions from a moderator. I mean, what's happened over the years in the same way that television as a whole has changed, debates have changed in that you're trying to score both on visual points, you're trying to look presidential, or you're trying to look like a strong candidate if you're running for a different office, and you're also trying to hit with that quick television moment. We had the zingers right at the beginning of this conversation. You're trying to score that moment, and that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with policy positions or you're standing on a particular issue. It's simply about what is the one thing that someone is going to take away from this event as a television program. That's kind of what it's turned into.
Right. The fringer candidates do not always get included, do they? Is there any precedent for that?
What tends to happen in the primary debate process is that it's not always been managed by any one entity. It would be a consortium of news organizations, maybe a political party, maybe the League of Women Voters, kind of a hodgepodge of different groups and organizations, and they would make their own criteria. And there's always going to be somebody who takes issue with those criteria. And so you will see debates that will have 10 candidates in them. You might see some that have only four or five. And that has come up over the years. That came up, in fact, in 1968, there were a number of Democrats who were running to succeed Lyndon Johnson, and only a handful of them were part of the one debate that took place in California. It was Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy. You didn't see Hubert Humphrey, who was also in the running. George McGovern had talked. In those days, the primary process was not as well defined in the same way that the debate process was not as well defined. Most candidates were trying to secure support at the convention, which was where the actual nomination was made, not through the primary process of winning votes and winning delegates in state primaries and in caucuses. In New Hampshire, the debate over which candidates should be allowed into a debate really came to a head in 1980. And there's the famous moment in the Republican debate. This is sort of a complicated story, but the long and the short of it was because of arguments between the campaigns about who should be included, whether it should just be Ronald Reagan, the former governor of California, and George H.W. Bush, or whether it should be the broader field that included a whole number of Republican hopefuls. Ronald Reagan ended up paying for the debate himself and including all of the candidates. What happened was that there was a continued argument about who should be up on the stage and who should not. And Reagan got into a debate with the moderator, who he called Mr. Green. Mr. Breen was his name, of the Nashua Telegraph. And they really got into it.
Let's hear a clip from that. This is from 1980.
An announcement. Would the sound man please turn Mr. Reagan's mic off for a minute? Is this on? Mr. Green,
did you turn that microphone
off? You asked for me if you would. I am paying for this microphone, Mr. Green.
That's a real moment. I mean, something is really happening there. It's memorable and quotable. Is that what candidates are trying to deliver? You know, the soundbite that everyone will remember them for?
They're trying to present a moment that will, in a way, encapsulate who they're trying to present themselves at. And for the supporters of Ronald Reagan in 1980, they said, here's a guy who was directly confronted with some opposition and he took charge. He said, that's what you need in a president of the United States. And they saw that as a big turning point for him, trying to fend off what was then his chief primary opponent, George H.W. Bush, and winning the New Hampshire primary and eventually the Republican nomination for president.
Speaking of zingers, we did hear the where's the beef comment from Walter Mondale to Gary Hart in 1984. Now, here's the one that won quite a few over to John McCain.
In case you missed it, a few days ago, Senator Clinton tried to spend $1 million on the Woodstock Concert Museum. Now, my friends, I wasn't there. I'm sure it was a cultural and pharmaceutical event. I was tied up at the time, but the fact is...
And you hear the roar from the crowd because he was literally tied up at the time. So that sort of generational conflict between the people who were fighting in Vietnam or in McCain's case, is a prisoner of war at that moment. And he's sort of characterizing Hillary Clinton and the Democrats as the peaceniks and the hippies just hanging out and taking drugs.
But that also gave John McCain a sense of humor. You know, it is through the long line of a political campaign, there are policy speeches, there are positions, there are platforms that are taken on things. But I feel like that was one of the things that was more memorable about John McCain's campaign. Is that true?
Increasingly, candidates want to present themselves not simply as in command of the facts and strong leaders, but also very relatable, very likable. Again, to use the analogy that presidential debates have become TV programs, you want to be a likable character. You want to be the one character, that the breakout character that everybody relates to, that everybody likes, that everybody tweets about. They like what you say. They like the way that you say it. They like how you look, and they like what they think you stand for.
Well, here's one of Joe Biden's 2008 breakout moments.
Rudy Giuliani, there's only three things he mentioned in a sentence, a noun and a verb and 9/11. I mean, there's nothing else. There's nothing else. And I mean it sincerely.
He kind of hit it out of the park with that one.
That's one, and you know that because you hear that to this day. When you hear Democrats responding to something that Rudy Giuliani said, even here in 2015, they will almost always refer to that Joe Biden quote when they make that reaction.
Well, sometimes the zingers don't quite land as intended. Let's hear just a little montage here of epic fails.
I'll tell you what. $10,000? $10,000 bet?
I'm not in the betting business. But
okay.
I don't think I'm that bad.
You're likable enough.
Thank you so much.
You know, lifting whole passages from someone else's speeches is not change you can believe in. It's change you can Xerox. And well, I just don't think. No, but, you know, but Barack, it is. Because if, you know.
Some memorable lines there.
Not everybody can pull off a good zinger. And, you know, whether that really tells you much about whether a person would be a good president of the United States or not, that has become sort of the moment that at least the national media points to and says, well, that line didn't land.
How about the role that the media plays here? I mean, if we're trying to keep things above board and really about the issues, what role is the debate moderator and the questions playing in how these candidates respond?
Well, I think, you know, to be frank, a lot of times, you know, media organizations are holding debates because they bring in a certain kind of audience. You know, they want to have people watching their station. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they are trying to hit policy positions or substantive issues the way that some people would prefer. There have been a number of attempts in the last few years to try and shake up the debate process. There was a famous one where there was a Democratic presidential forum in the 2008 campaign, and there were questions coming from YouTube. YouTube was one of the media sponsors of the debate. And so one of the voters, well, at least they said he was a voter, was dressed up as a snowman. And he asked a question to the Democratic candidates for president of the United States about climate change while dressed as a snowman.
Hello, Democratic candidates. I've been growing concerned that global warming, the single most important issue to the snowmen of this country, is being neglected.
One of the things that the debate tradition does is exposes, you know, the unguarded self. You get asked a question you're not prepared for. You don't have a talking point for. Kind of exposing the human frailties. Here's a famous example.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see, I can't, the third, sorry, oops.
I mean, that really was the Rick Perry's blown it moment.
And you could see, I was actually not watching the debate when that happened, but I was following it on Twitter, and you could see the tweets were, not that tweets can be catastrophic, but the reaction on social media from sort of the movers and shakers in the National Press Corps was, that's it, his campaign is literally over. And he did stay in the race for a while afterwards, but never quite recovered.
And it's moments like that that have made some of these presidential campaigns ripe for parody. Let's remember some of the famous parodies of presidential debates.
Rather than squander the surplus on a risky tax cut for the wealthy, I would put it in what I call a lockbox.
Governor Bush, your response.
I don't know what that was all about. But I will tell you this, don't mess with Texas.
Senator Palin, address your position on global warming and whether or not you think it's man-made or not.
Gwen, we don't know if this climate change, whoosie, what's it, is man-made or if it's just a natural part of the end of days.
Yeah, debates are great fodder for satirists. Saturday Night Live has had not only Sarah Palin's imitation by Tina Fey, but also Dana Carvey's impression of George H.W. Bush in the 1980s, which was originally much more cutting than it has become. There was the famous parody debate between Bush and Michael Dukakis, the Democratic nominee, and Dana Carvey as Bush creates this very long string of kind of half sentences, and then Dukakis, played by John Lovitz, just looks over and says, I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
You still have a minute 20, Mr. Vice President.
Well, sure, more has to be done, but the program is in place. Make no mistake, we are doing the job. So let's just stay the course and keep on track. Stay the course.
You still have 50 seconds left, Mr. Vice President.
Well, let me just sum up. On track. Stay the course. 1,000 points of light. Stay the course.
Mm-hmm. Governor Dukakis, rebuttal.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
So debates are great entertainment, great for parody. But to summarize this real question, I mean, too many candidates means too much competition for the soundbite, the zinger, not enough substance. What do you say to that?
I would also add to that that there are concerns there are just too darn many debates. In the 2012 campaign, the Republican candidates were in 20 debates, including an evening debate in Manchester, New Hampshire, followed by a morning debate in Concord, New Hampshire, the very next day. So there have been a lot of efforts not only to winnow down how many candidates are in the events, but how often the events themselves take place. You can look at debates a lot of ways. You can look at debates as a way to learn about the candidates. You can look at debates as a way to look at how candidates relate to each other, what it might tell us about how they would perform in office. You can look at debates as a kind of entertainment, a sports kind of event for people who like to follow politics. It's always worth looking at what debates are and how they play out. What is important, I think, is to not assume that a debate is going to reveal anything that we don't already know about a candidate or a campaign, that it may just be an interesting chance for a candidate to either distinguish themselves positively or negatively.
Brady Carlson, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, thanks.
NHPR reporter, host, and author of the upcoming book, Dead Presidents, Brady Carlson. You can find his list of curated highlights from presidential debates at wordofmouthradio.org. When you think debate club, suit coats, ties, and Alex Keaton, earnestness may come to mind. But there's a completely new style of debate emerging on college campuses today, and it's attracting a fresh set of young voices. State of the Reunion and producer J.P. Davidson bring us the story.
When they're competing, traditional college policy debaters talk insanely fast.
First off, the criticism test is second class by a series of different groups of the debate, and the press, why much smaller than them together, and do you want me to march this whole thing?
That's the Kansas City team at the 2008 National Debate Championship. Apparently, the judges can actually follow what they're saying. For a long time, that machine gun pace was the standard for college debate. But when people like Davon Love got involved, everything changed.
I mean, I thought debate was like two podiums and people talking about trying to sound good about whatever, suits and ties, and, you know, trying to use a bigger word than the other person who spoke. You know, that's what I thought it was.
You really wouldn't think Davon would be a force for change in the debate world. He grew up in a not-so-great neighborhood in Baltimore, and he wasn't interested in school. Debate wasn't even on his radar. But one morning, when he was a sophomore in high school, he showed up early to school. It was cold out, and he needed an excuse to get into the building.
So I told the people at the front, I'm coming for debate practice.
And once he saw what debate was all about, he was kind of into it. Here were kids like him actually being listened to. Pretty soon, he realized this could be his ticket into college. His parents couldn't afford it, so really, it might be his only chance.
So that was really my motivation, and so I just put a lot of energy into getting as good as I possibly could.
And Davon got good, really good, and he made it into college at Towson University. On the Towson debate team, he joined up with another ambitious African-American debater, Devin Cooper. They both had major problems with the usual way debate was being practiced, so they decided to stop following the standard machine gun style. They felt like it really stacked the deck against African-American students.
Because the research methodology and the pedagogy are such that it recreates the structures of society. You know, and our argument was that as college debaters, as scholars, it is our responsibility to orient our scholarship in such a way where one could be equipped to challenge the dynamics in society that cause the conditions that exist in aggrieved communities.
So Davon and Devin decided to join a movement that was trying to change the language of debate and add new weapons to its arsenal, like hip-hop.
I see no changes. Wake up in the morning and I ask myself, is life worth living? Should I blast myself? I'm tired of being poor and even worse, I'm black. My stomach hurts, so I'm looking for a purse to snatch. Cops give a damn about a Negro.
The team brought their new style to Nationals in 2008. They were competing at the highest level.
From Towson University, Devin Cooper and Davon Love.
To get started, they played a track by Baltimore spoken word artists Archie the Messenger and Lyrical the Lyricist. A pretty unorthodox move.
This is my pain on paper. This is my pain on paper. This is poetry. Now this is spoken word. Spoken through open source, spoken through broken vocal cords. This is the prequel to the sequel. The anger of the unequal. This is the bleeds to a white tee. This is the peace sign to a t-shirt that says kill white tee. This is the cure to jungle fever. This is the video game that made the White House Resident Evil. This is my pain on paper.
And that track wasn't just for show. It was a key part of their argument.
We don't claim that you know, all black people are oppressed as individuals. Our argument is that the institutions that create the type of oppression that exists cause the type of psychological damage as well as being less able to access the means of power that Archie the Messenger talks about.
What they were saying was that the practices of the debate community perpetuate inequalities in society, and that these problems need to be fixed before they could have a really useful debate about something like U.S. foreign policy. That was actually the topic they were supposed to be tackling at the championship. But instead, they did their own thing. It was a long shot, so nobody was expecting this.
In the round between the affirmative, from Towson, Devin Cooper, and Davon Love, and the negative, Nate Johnson and Chris Stone, the decision is a 7-4 for the affirmative.
They won, and the fast talkers lost. It was big.
It was huge. I think that was the first time that an all-African-American team had won the national tournament, and then doing it in a style that endured so much backlash and hostility was really big. So it kind of set that particular style in stone as something that's going to continue in the community. They can't get rid of it. It's going to be there. And it's a force to be reckoned with.
That's Tiffany Dillard Knox. She's the acting director of the University of Louisville debate program. Louisville actually invented the new style that Davon and Devin used to win. Back in 2000, Louisville started working to recruit more African-American students. Debaters started blending their cultural identities with their arguments. And pretty soon, a whole new way of delivering those arguments had evolved. And it's no surprise that the Towson team took on that new style. Devin Cooper actually got his start on the Louisville team before transferring back home to Baltimore. Not everyone was happy about the spread of the new style, though. Some traditional debaters were actually outraged to see their activity and their community start to change. And it was changing.
It's interesting that, you know, people talk about the style of debate, but it's more of a social movement, really, because we had to carve out a space for this style to even be acceptable, and it's still not fully accepted, but it's gained some traction, and it's more like a social movement that's beginning to snowball.
And that snowball just keeps growing. Davon is teaching high school debate now, and schools keep pushing debate in new directions. The style/movement has been around for over a decade now, and at Towson, students are still trying new things. Students like senior Benjamin Morgan.
This piece I wrote is called I Get Out, and it tries to explain like the relationship that I shared to the debate and trying to get out between the gap between my lived experiences and our words. So I say, I get out between the gap of explaining and resisting, enlisting and deserting a wall I stay missing. The from the corner whose mission to go to college, position to be a scholar, still relegated the squalor, the object of your oppression, objectifies his conceptions in college to gain knowledge in white spaces he stepped in. Pock, knock, knock on the door, but never let in. Fiasco, we let the get go, a little weapon against deceptions, don't accept their misconceptions. The world was superimposed on my progression. Resolutions, solutions drenched in illusions, delusions of institutions with slave blood running through them. Whiteness over black, righteousness and crack. After I escape, they try to signify us back to human locations, can't put us on the map. I pull heaven from the sky to bring your world into the trap. Heaven into hell was slavery to jail. You're framing me as prisoner, can't provide me bail. Your world is a jail and we're Jonathan Jackson. Death is inevitable and suicide is action.
That was tough, brother. That
was tough. Now high school urban debate leagues are joining the movement too. And that matters, because high school debate leads to college debate. And from college debate, why not politics? And from there, well, the potential is limitless. For State of the Reunion, I'm JP Davidson.
And a little postscript to that story, Davon Love is now Director of Research and Public Policy at Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. That's a grassroots think tank based in Baltimore, Maryland. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you'll find the Word of Mouth podcast, or you can search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth here on New Hampshire Public Radio.